What's on your mind right now? The song you can't get out of your head? That breaking story? Or that conversation you just have to be a part of?
That's the brand new song from...
This is a breaking news report.
He shoots! He scores!
That's radio. Happening now. Connecting you to what matters most exactly when it's happening. From the airwaves to every device you stream on, radio is everywhere you are. It's local, live, and it's for you. Tag your favorite radio station this Wednesday on social media and use hashtag National Radio Day to celebrate. That's hashtag National Radio Day.
Swinging a high drive into center field, hits at the wall, it is gone! Hassis does it again!
Again!
It's gone! It's into the bullpen! This game is tied! This game is tied!
He swings and rips one to center field. It's high, it's deep, it's back, it's gone! Sale winds, he fires. Swing and miss, strike three, it's over! The Red Sox have won the World Championship!
Welcome back to Play Tessie. It's a bonus episode for you today, and we got a very special guest for his Play Tessie debut today. We got current Red Sox and former Red Sox. Is that how we're supposed to say it? Current and former Red Sox pitcher Robert Staak here today. Is that how you tell it? Like, are you current and former? Or you just current?
I would say former and currently minor leaguer trying to become a back to the big league. So,
well, we really appreciate you coming on. You're a Red Sox. You're a Red Sox pitcher. So Robert Staak signed minor league deal with the Red Sox. You've pitched for what, I believe 10 different major league organizations. Is that right? 10?
Yeah.
10 different organizations. And so here's for those of you who don't know, this is the sequence here. Drafted by the Cardinals in 09 as a catcher, then pitched in the organizations of the Astros, Pirates, Reds, Padres, where he made his major league debut, Phillies, Red Sox in 2020, which we definitely got to talk about later in the show that year. So many wild stories that you must have about pitching in Major League Baseball that year. But then we've got the Cubs, the Mets, and the Brewers. And now back to the Red Sox after a stint in Mexico. I believe the KBO in there as well. So you've been around the block. Like, you've had a baseball journey, to say the least.
Yeah, the last pitch I made in the big leagues was... I pitched the top of the first inning for the Mets, and then I tried to beat out what I thought could be an infield single when I was hitting and tore my hamstring, and haven't touched the big league field since. So working to try and get back.
Yeah, we can't let that be the way you finish up your career. Like you said you were going to pitch till 50 on Baseball Isn't Boring. And we're going to hold you to that. I know you've got it in you.
Perfect.
Yeah. But curious though, as someone who's pitched for 10 different organizations and multiple other leagues, like when you go from one organization to the next, do they always have something new for you to try out? Are they always trying to get you to try these things that you haven't before? And can you like tell the difference in the quality of like the coaching and the player development teams that each of the organizations have?
Yeah, there's always teams have different spin on things, but also even like the same team might be different years later, right? So the last year I was in the minor leagues with the Cardinals was 2014. So, you know, what they're doing in 2025 is going to be entirely different 11 years later. So I can't really like speak to what a lot of organizations I was with years ago. And even the Red Sox in 2020, I think that like if you go and look through their staff, you know, top to bottom, is going to be quite different. So baseball is always changing. Teams are always different.
Oh, yeah. Red Sox have changed big time. They've outlawed the four-seam fastball. Not really, but a lot less four-seam fastballs. What I want to know is, you mentioned when you were speaking with Brad Foe on Baseball Isn't Boring, you said the Brewers highlighted your sinker, and they said that's your key. If you want to get back to the majors and stick, you need to use the sinker. Did they dig into why that pitch specifically was the one that they liked?
Yeah, well, usually, you know, there's for a fastball, there's such thing as the dead zone. The dead zone is average movement. Average movement, not for big leagues, but like, you know, minor leaguers, high school, college, whatever. And it's called the dead zone because a hitter sees a fastball that moves like that so often that it's so much easier for them to hit than a really good rising four seam or a sinker. And so most pitchers will find themselves in that dead zone. And if you want to be successful, you either have to throw like 102, so it's so fast it doesn't matter, or get the ball to go up or get the ball to go down, but you can't be in the middle. And unfortunately, that's where a fastball just naturally lied, was in the middle.
So after they told you that about the sinker and the fastball dead zone, what was the next move for you? Was it reshaping the sinker, or was it just changing the usage?
It was, just getting a feel for the grip and using it in the game. And it was initially terrible. It's so hard when you're throwing a four seam, you're trying to get behind the ball, you're trying to backspin it, and you're trying to throw it so that it goes just up and down. And then when you throw a sinker, you're trying to be as inefficient with the spin as possible. You're trying to get it, like, you don't want to rip the seams because you want it to have low spin rate. You want it to spin kind of off to the side because you want it to be inefficient. And so basically it's the exact opposite of every other fastball I had thrown in my life. And so actually when I was with the Red Sox in 2020, they showed me the sinker grip that I even use now. But at the time I was on the 40 man, and I knew that it was a huge undertaking to, just go into throwing sinkers right away. And so I didn't do that then. But then years later, it's like, okay, I'm committed to it. Let's see what happens. And what happened was I was terrible. I was in AAA with the Brewers, just like hitting dudes in the head, walking everyone. And it was awful. So there was a reason why I hadn't done it beforehand, but I stuck with it for the next year and a half in independent ball and the Mexican leagues until I feel like I've got a better grip, feel for it now.
We already kind of alluded to it, but the last time we saw you, there was no one in the stands. It was 2020. And worth noting, you were coming from like a three-quarter slot. And you tweeted the other day that kind of side-by-side where you're more leaning towards the sidearm delivery. What was that transition like? What made you do that? And how long did that take to kind of adjust?
So it didn't happen consciously. I was starting last year in Mexico. And, throughout the course of a game, you always have pitches that like, oh, I was a little bit lower arm slot there just on accident. This one, I was higher. And I noticed that every time I was lower, it had a pretty good result. So I kind of started leaning into it and throwing lower and lower. And so if you were to look at my average arm, pitch height release, it would have probably, fallen every month until the winter league. I was still going over the top to left-handed hitters and sidearm to righties. And after my second start in the winter, I was like, screw it. We're doing everything sidearm because it's just so much better.
Was there like a specific moment when you were on the mound, like a specific pitch even, when you got that movement you were looking for, like the oh shit moment that you can kind of point to where you realize like, okay, I need to keep on doing the sidearm?
Not any one pitch specifically, but there's like a certain pitch location when you throw it down and inside to a right-hander, that starts on the plate and then breaks like down towards their feet basically. It's just the nastiest pitch. It's, I remember as a hitter facing that as a left-handed hitter against a left-handed sinker being like, this is just impossible. I don't know how you're supposed to hit this. And, so whenever I get one of those, it's good. The hard thing is that if you aim for kind of like that inside corner and you're throwing a sinker that's moving, 20 inches of run, like you can kind of also easily hit the batter. So I typically aim on the outside corner and just let it run back over the plate as opposed to aim the inside corner and try and get that nasty chase pitch because it's just a better risk reward to do that.
So you're aiming for the break point, kind of, not where you want the pitch to end. You're aiming for, man, how do you, I don't know how you put that into words. You're aiming for where the pitch is going to break, kind of, it sounds like.
I'm aiming for where I'd like to start it and then let the movement take it elsewhere.
Okay. Yeah. God, I love that. That's like the high level baseball stuff that my brain can barely wrap around and quantify at all. But go ahead, Pat. I know you had a follow up.
Yeah. So between, the sinker being thrown more, the new arm slot, you by far threw the most innings ever probably in your life this past calendar year. How is your arm with all of this going on? How are you feeling right now? Giving yourself a little bit of a break now?
Yeah, my arm is great. After I signed with the Red Sox, I took 10 days off of no throw just to, get some sort of a break. But then I'm ramping right back up right now. And my arm feels good. It's one of those things where ultimately your velocity is a tick slower when you're throwing sidearm, which I've noticed has basically like have no stress on my elbow like that. You have to maintain your shoulder and your obliques and stuff a little bit more because you're throwing kind of bent over. But in general, I think it's easier on the arm to throw sidearm. So I've had no issues with throwing a career high in innings.
So on the subject of the Red Sox, so they approached you at some point this offseason. Talk about how that went, because you had an incredible season in the Winter League in Mexico, pitching Triple Crown, like legitimately amazing numbers. You can go to his baseball reference page and look for yourself. It's awesome stuff. And like, clearly the Red Sox saw that and saw any, I don't know if they told you about any sort of data that they saw or what they've told you they want you to do or what they foresee your role to be, but talk about that process of them approaching you and how it moved forward from there.
Yeah. I mean, the process is really just my agent texts me like, hey, the Red Sox, I'm talking with the Red Sox about you. Nothing firm yet, but they're, you know, can you send them the video of your next game and the date of your next game? And so of course I, oh my gosh, okay, well, I got to go have a good game. So I did that and then sent them the data. And they're like, all right, I was talking to a couple other teams and a different team had offered me a contract first, but my agent and I felt like the Red Sox were a better fit. And so they basically just take the contract to the Red Sox and say, hey, would you beat this? Like, sure. All right, we're in. So, you know, when we're talking about minor league contracts, it's such small, you know, small dealings that they don't, you know, if they want you, they'll get you. And also I want to be back so badly that it's not like there's hard negotiations going on or anything.
Right. So when you last pitched for the Red Sox, obviously coming out of the bullpen, your most recent appearances have all been starts. Have they told you what they want you doing when you get to spring training this year? Are you going to be stretched out or are you going to be coming in as a reliever?
From what I heard, I think in spring training, and obviously like this was just like my agent told me this a couple weeks ago and it could easily change, right? But I think in spring I'll start in AAA, I would start. And then in all likelihood, if I was to get called up, it would be whatever they need, you know, bullpen. It's just like I'd be like a guy that's like, okay, we had an emergency, come help us out. And then when you have that opportunity, you hope that you can turn that emergency help into a routine thing.
How good does it feel for you? I mean, you've been, Gordo went up and down your resume briefly at the beginning here, but to be, you know, in the KBO, in the Mexican leagues, up and down in the minors, and now you're back with a shot to make it to the major league team. What's your mental like right now? Because I can't imagine, it's got to be a little bit jarring, but also a bit of a relief that you're close again.
Yeah, to get back at my age and with my, you know, history, you have to have done something pretty good for them to want you, right? So in that line of thinking, I feel like the most confident in my ability to pitch that I've ever, you know, felt in my career. So I'm excited to go basically, you know, deploy that against hitters. At the same time, you know that you're at the end of your line here at 35 if you don't hit the ground running. So I feel great about my confidence in my ability to get people out. And I better because I have to go do that immediately or I'm not going to last very long. So it's high pressure, but also I feel like I'm up to the task.
So you just said at your age, if you don't make it, you're kind of, you know, close to the end of the line. You said with Bradfo on his show, you said you described yourself as unappealing to teams, which, you know, you don't hear that from big league pitchers very often. Is this a mindset of self-awareness that you've always had or did you develop that along the way?
I've just played for a really long time. You know, I was drafted when I was 19 and I'm 35 now. And I feel like I like to have an honest look at like why so-and-so doesn't make it, why they do. And a lot of times that, you know, like the answer is pretty obvious if you're willing to look at it in the right lens, which is, you know, I think with Bradfield, you might've heard me describe that every minor leaguer is a lottery ticket. The younger you are, the higher, you know, result or like, you know, winnings you could be because you could develop in anything. And the older you are, they feel like, we kind of know what you are, right? And so for me to have been around for so long and not become like a good major league pitcher, you have to do things extraordinarily different or better for them to care. Whereas if you're, you know, if I was half as good as I was, but I was only 22, I would have been signed, you know, last year because they can project so much, but there's no projecting a 35-year-old there. You know, what are you right this second? And, you can't just be good enough to be the worst guy, the worst pitcher on the team. They already have worst pitchers on the team that are 23 that need those roster spots. You know, they're only looking to sign people who can come in and set like a lot of games. If you think about it, there's like an A team and a B team of relievers, for instance, right? There's the guys who come in when you're winning to lock down the win. And there's guys that come in when you're losing because they, you know, just want to keep the game close or they just need to provide innings and this is who you have, right? So they're not that interested in signing guys to fill into the B team. They have those guys already, right? So that's okay, why yeah. The older you get, you got to be better.
It's an unbelievably, like, it's a brutally honest mindset. And, you know, you've been playing, you said drafted at 19, you're 35 now. I'm sure you've played with a lot of different guys. Have you run into anyone along your career, and I don't want names, but anyone who has the opposite mindset, the kind of not delusional, but the a little too confident, not realistic enough mindset? Have you run into those guys? And if so, have you ever, you know, talked to them about it?
All the time. You run into people who are, you know, unwilling to have any sort of adversity, and just, but the reason why, you know, those guys are either going to make it and be good right away, and in all likelihood they won't, and then they'll just be out of baseball the next year. I think I personally have the feeling that a lot of players think that the grass is greener on the other side when they think, oh, you know what, instead of grinding out here in the minors, I could be doing something else, right? And think about some just like desk job. And then, but 2 years later down the road, when they're still sitting at their desk job, it's like, what are you doing? You know, that can wait any time, right? So when I said that I'm, you know, even if I don't have as many opportunities as I'd like for the major leagues, there's still all sorts of leagues that's why I said, well, I'm going to play until I'm 50 regardless. It's just, I'd like to be playing in the best league, not in the, you know, independent leagues.
So we had already alluded to it, and you said it yourself, baseball in teams and organizations are constantly changing and evolving. I mean, we'll get to 2020, but you didn't even play under Alex Cora. Like, Ron Renicki was here. Dave Bush was the pitching coach. Chaim Bloom was running the team. So you're kind of coming into a familiar organization with some new faces. In a guy like Andrew Bailey, who has such a great track record, how excited are you on your end to kind of let his hands kind of go on you and help you kind of mold what you're going to be?
I'm extremely excited. Like, I know that the Red Sox are a very forward-thinking organization in terms of, you know, player development. And even though I'm an older guy, that, you know, how many new tricks can I learn? I think I can learn new stuff, and especially with, just like you said, with these really valuable coaches. So I haven't looked into like individual people very much, to be honest, because like, what do I need to do when I go to spring training? I need to go up and I need to throw nasty pitches in the strike zone, right? There's nothing really else that I need to do. So I know that whoever they have to help will help me do that. And that's kind of it.
So Pat talked about 2020 there with Renicki and Dave Bush. I got to get into this year with you, because this is one of the most fascinating seasons, not even just like for Major League Baseball, because of all the rules and restrictions and the no fans and the stuffed animals and the cardboard cutouts in the seats. Like, what was that fever dream like for you? Like, you got to the Red Sox, if I'm not mistaken, what, like a few days into the season, and spent the rest of the year there. What was it like just in general to be a Major League pitcher in that year?
It was ridiculous, you know. firstly, like, trying to join a new team when you're not allowed to hang out with each other, when you have to be wearing like masks in the bullpen, so you can't really like see each other's faces when you're talking, you know. It's just it was the most that baseball will ever just be a desk job, you know, where you're just showing up, punching your ticket and leaving. So it was also the season, do you remember when a guy like scaled the monster? I was there in the bullpen.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes. That was so crazy.
What are you saying? He was like trying to make like a peace offering to one of the New York teams, I think.
He was yelling at one of the players. And, you know, I kind of just remember us going like, okay, don't fall, right? But also get out of here. You know?
Yeah. How does someone even, I've never been able to figure out, like, walking around the ballpark, walking in the ballpark, how someone gets up there from the outside. Doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure since then they've scaled up security, right? But he on the other side of the wall, I don't know what's there, but you know, he obviously climbed it.
Yeah, that moment, and then when the Red Sox won the 2018 World Series and the banner fell off the truck. Robert, I don't know if you've heard about this. The banner fell off of some truck that was taking it to Fenway, and these guys are doing an interview. They're like, yeah, we got the banner. It fell off the truck. If you want it back, you got to give us tickets. I think those two fans, the guy who scaled the Green Monster, I feel like that is what players who are not from the New England area, I feel like that's what you guys think Red Sox fans are like generally in a nice, am I close with that?
I kid you not, the first time that I was in Boston and I heard someone that had like the most stereotypical accent, like I thought they were joking. Like, no one actually talks like that, right? Right? No, this is real. Okay. Everything I thought might've been true about Boston.
The ones who do are legit. It sounds like an exaggeration, but there are people. Like, I don't think any of us, we don't have it, but there are people, and it's no joke.
Yeah.
So like, speaking of Boston fans, like, I know we have our reputation. We're loud, we're brash. Did you feel a little bit like you were missing out, not getting the full 2020 Boston experience?
Oh yeah. I pitched in Fenway for, you know, that was like half of a season basically, but I don't really feel like I pitched in Fenway. I've, you know, pitched on the mound, but without a single fan there, that's not really the, you know, even close to the same experience. So I'm, you know, just itching to try and get the actual Fenway, you know, Red Sox, Yankees, you know, type of game. So, you know, that's a huge thing I'm looking forward to if I can get up.
One fan. There was one fan.
Yeah, you're right.
One fan. Yeah, you're right, Sammy. One fan.
Top of the monster.
When you're running from the bullpen to the mound in a completely empty Fenway in a real major league game, like, what is that first time like? What, like, obviously you're focused on, you know, going out there, executing and all that, but kind of in the peripherals, what's going through your head in that moment?
To be honest, it's not that big of a difference, because as a player that's, you know, on the chopping block, which you are if you were in my spot that I was and still will be, the pressure that you care about fans screaming at you, non-existent. You know, you don't hear a single thing that's said from the stands when you're pitching. And so nobody there or 30,000, 40,000 people, it really makes no difference, because you know that you're pitching, it's just you and the batter, and that's your, you know, spot in the big league. So I don't think it's going to make much difference. I've played in, you know, rainy games in the big leagues when there was no fans, and I've played in, you know, Dodger Stadium with 45,000, whatever. And honestly, it doesn't feel that big of a difference.
It's a good mindset to have towards it. I always do wonder this though, about guys who played on the 2020 team. And it's honestly probably a really good question for you, since you came in, like, you weren't there for the Red Sox spring training before the shutdown or anything.
No.
So you get there, and I, like, can they even, like, how do they even try to help you implement new things? Like, Ron Renneke's the manager. Like, what was it like working with him, or could, like, did you even feel like you were able to work with some of the staff there at that time?
Yeah, no, you could work with the staff, because you could still throw bullpens, and, you know, that's really when you're practicing the game, it's, or, you know, you've got your game outings, and you can talk about that with the coaches afterwards, or in the bullpen, you could talk with the coach. So there was no difference in terms of player development in that sense. But also, when you're like a new addition to the team and you're thrust in the big leagues pretty quickly, it's kind of just sink or swim, right? There's not that much to be learning. Because at the end of the day, when you're in AAA, when you're in, I guess at that time, what was it called? The alternate site? You can develop in the alternate site, but in the big leagues, right, go get an out. Whatever you have to do to get an out, do that, right? So I guess unless you're like on a losing team and you're one of the young prospects, they could be like, we're going to throw 30% changeups today no matter what. But that's really kind of minor league stuff.
What's on your mind right now? The song you can't get out of your head? That breaking story? Or that conversation you just have to be a part of?
That's the brand new song from...
This is a breaking news report.
He shoots! He scores!
That's radio. Happening now. Connecting you to what matters most exactly when it's happening. From the airwaves to every device you stream on, radio is everywhere you are. It's local, live, and it's for you. Tag your favorite radio station this Wednesday on social media and use hashtag National Radio Day to celebrate. That's hashtag National Radio Day.
Mm. So you talk about, you know, simplifying it, just get it out. You also talk a lot about pitch metrics, and this is something that has grown in baseball. I think we're all aware of that. You talked about how you had it major leagues, in the Mexican leagues, KBO. There's always pitch metrics is what you said with Bradfo. And I just wanted to see from the perspective of a big leaguer, what are pitch metrics? If you're explaining it to someone who has no clue about what anything in baseball is, how would you describe pitch metrics?
I would term it mostly as just like the shape of your pitch. The velocity matters too. You can have if you sacrifice too much velocity to get a bigger pitch movement, like that's not necessarily better. But really, pitch metrics is just the shape of your pitch. You can also factor in like, where did you release it from? You know, where did you get kind of low down? Did you get high up? But for the most part, it's the shape of the pitch, because on the screen, all you see is, oh, that slider was 86, right? But that doesn't, that hardly tells you anything about the slider. So you can call guys up from the minor leagues a lot faster than you could back in the day because you have all of these pitch metrics. You know, like, hey, a pitch that is thrown at 92 miles an hour with negative 2 inches of vertical break and 0 inches of horizontal has high success in the big leagues. And this guy's doing this in A ball. Well, that'll work in the big leagues too, right? So people can kind of rock it through because of all this knowledge of pitch metrics.
Mm-hmm. Can you give me an example of a time when maybe a pitching coach was talking to you about the shape of a pitch and they told you to change it? Like, how do you go about changing a pitch shape?
It's all trial and error, right? You say, like, if you want to get more negative horizontal, that's also just like more sweep on a pitch, you can try this grip. Try the feeling of, you know, throwing it more to the side, like have your finish be more to the side rather than down. Just those are all kind of pitching or coaching cues and the grips. And it's okay, here's a trackman, throw it like this. Okay, try something different. Whatever you want to try, just try it and let's see if that worked, right? And then you throw a good one and they'll immediately ask you, okay, what were you feeling on that? Because they want to make sure that whatever you're feeling, let's see if that's a repeatable cue.
Since you've been drafted, obviously, like metrics and like we've seen the absolute boom of things like driveline and biomechanics and all of this stuff. As your career has kind of progressed, how have you integrated these new metrics and this new information and this new science into how you kind of go about your business?
Oh, well, firstly, because I haven't really stuck with one organization ever, I'm following a bunch of people on Twitter that are like the really nerdy data dudes that are always sharing like public information. And then like, you'll be like, wow, this guy is sharing really valuable stuff. And then 6 months later, you'll see that I can't share this stuff anymore. I just got hired by such and such team. Right. And so it's been really valuable to me, you know, for instance, knowing like, okay, actually a sweeper is better if it has positive vertical break. That's like something that I saw that like Driveline posted a graph on Twitter. Great. That's cool information. That's good for me to know, put it in my, you know, pocket. So, seeing all that out there has helped me kind of for free. Also, I've done pitch design elsewhere, it's so important to know you can have all this data telling you your information, but what's the goal? And so you have to know what you're actually working to achieve.
How active are you on baseball or I guess Red Sox Twitter, baseball Twitter? How often are you, you know, reading Twitter?
Every day, all the time. I love seeing the more of like the coaching and instruction part than like every time I see fans like, I can't believe you traded for this guy or what were you thinking signing that guy? It's like, shut up. You don't know anything. You know absolutely nothing, you know. That's what it feels like as a player because you know like, oh yeah, you know, a Brad from Kentucky, you know better than the GM, you know, who has all the data and is getting paid to do this. Yeah. Sorry, Brad from Kentucky, if you're a real person.
Yeah, Brad from Kentucky is going to be pissed. He had a great idea for his team.
Yeah.
But that's great. So I was going to ask, do you think it's a useful tool for you to have baseball Twitter? But it sounds like it's definitely a useful tool.
Yeah, if you follow the right people, otherwise you could just, you know, be arguing with dudes about dumb stuff all day long.
Yeah, absolutely. So Pitching Ninja, another thing that we have to cover, when that tweet of your pitch, forget how we framed it, but when he tweeted about you, you had to have been pretty fired up. I feel like that's like a job resume item for a baseball player.
Almost. It was. He tweeted that, and a couple of days later, that was when teams started reaching out to me. So if, you know, it's also the time of year when a team would reach out to you regardless. So if it's coincidental or not, it probably helps at some degree, right?
It can't hurt. Who, Gordo, you'll know this. Who did the Red Sox sign and they said it was partially because of, Whitlock.
Dude, it was Whitlock. It was Garrett Whitlock on Instagram. Yeah.
Because he posted something on Instagram. They're like, we'll trade for him, Yankees. Yeah. Hey, social media.
Literal Rule 5 pick made off of an Instagram video.
Like, yeah, well, you know, maybe if your job is to hire people and you have three dudes sitting in front of you that look equally good, but one guy's kind of hyped up because the internet loves him. Like, okay, well, that's the, you know, weight in favor of that guy. Sure.
Yeah. A little marketing boost too.
So on the subject of Twitter, I have to ask, your wife's pinned tweet.
All right. So this was in 2020. She said, zero times divorced, but if he keeps walking the leadoff batter, I'll consider filing.
Yeah. So someone had like taken a still of me, like a picture of me while I was warming up the bullpen, just looking slovenly, right? It was 2020. We didn't go to the barber. We didn't eat very well because what are you going to do, you know? So I'm not looking my best. And someone goes, you got to take a look at this guy. He looks, you know, like he's been three times divorced. And my wife saw it and thought it was funny. So she hit back with that tweet.
Does that make it back to like the clubhouse? Or can you even, like, I don't even know what the clubhouse is like back then, because I know you guys had all, weren't you guys like in suites?
Yes, we were up at, like, I shared a suite with just one other person. And again, like I said, you know, I wasn't with the team in spring training, and we weren't really like, there was no opportunity to like make friends or anything. So a couple of people have mentioned it to me, but it wouldn't be the same if it was any other season. Then that would have been like up in the clubhouse with the whole team laughing at it.
Projector screen on the wall.
Exactly. Yeah.
Robert, I'm going to be brutally honest here. This is probably the hardest question you will ever face from us or media all season long.
Sure.
Me, myself, I am a movie guy. I am a cinephile. Word on the street is you are also a very big movie guy.
I was until 2 years ago. I had a daughter and my movie watching has plummeted. So if you asked me for a movie before then.
Oh, easy. Yes. Okay, sure. Absolutely. First off, it's a two-part question. Do you use Letterboxd, and do you know what Letterboxd is?
I do know what Letterboxd is because I see like reels of actors talking about it, but I don't have it myself. I obviously should get it, but I feel like it's only taken off in popularity the last couple of years, right?
What's Letterboxd?
Oh, yeah.
I don't even know what this is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've never even heard
Letterboxd?
Of
this. Letterboxd like is, it's a, you watch a movie and then you rate it on Letterboxd, 0 to 5 stars, and you can write a little review. But this is perfect, Robert, because you've seen the videos. Your top 4 movies of all time.
Gladiator is my number one. Do I have to put like Lord of the Rings like one by one, or can I just say
No. So Lord of the Rings, we'll count that as one, and Godfather 1 and 2, we will count as one.
Okay. I'm sorry, because the Godfather would not make my top 4. Not that it's not great, right? But
oh, Pat.
Yeah.
Oh no.
It's a great film, right? But
it is.
I would say I would put There Will Be Blood. Well, I'm a huge Daniel Day-Lewis fan, so I got to put There Will Be Blood.
Same here.
Right.
Absolutely. Same here.
And then I feel, just because Martin McDonagh, who has, he's made 4 films and they're all bangers. So I got to just put one in there, right?
In Bruges?
That one's great. But Sam Rockwell. Yeah, he's in that one, but he's not as big of a part. I'm going 7 Psychopaths so I can get more. Ooh. Sam Rockwell. Yeah.
Oh, great. Love it.
Yeah.
Absolutely love it.
We gotta get like a panel, you two and then Giolito. And just like talk about movie. Wait, did you see what's the one? Nosferatu. It just came out, but did you get time to sneak out and see it?
I haven't seen it yet. Is it worth it?
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah,
it's
really so good. You know how when you see like a scary movie, sometimes they reveal the monster and you're like, nah, it's stupid. Like that one's terrible. The opposite. This one was like, oh my god, that's actually terrifying looking.
Okay.
And not goofy. And the guy, what's his name?
Bill Skarsgård.
Bill Skarsgård.
Yeah. He's like 6'4", so he's just, you know, like hulking Nosferatu.
Okay.
Great.
Yeah. Good. And I'm a humongous like cinematography nerd. Robert Eggers crushed it.
Yeah.
The cinematography is phenomenal.
Okay.
It's so good.
He did like
highly recommend.
Viking something.
The Viking, The Lighthouse, The Witch.
Yeah. So I am pitifully, I haven't watched any of those yet, right? So that just means I've got 4 great films to watch.
That's your homework before we see you in Fort Myers. There you go.
Okay.
All right. I got one for you. This is completely different. Did you grow up in Bellevue?
No, I moved when I was 5 and I live mostly in like a suburb of Los Angeles.
Okay. So well, I wanted to ask you about the Seattle dog. Have you had one of those?
Is it a hot dog? Are we talking about?
Yeah. So it's okay. No, bear with me. Tell me if hot this is close. I had it and it was really good when I was in Seattle.
Yeah.
It's a regular hot dog with sauteed onions, and then they smear cream cheese on the inside of the bun.
Yeah, it sounds delicious.
Okay. Thank you. Part 2. Yeah. Have you had a Fenway Frank?
No, I haven't had a Fenway Frank.
So next time we talk to you, we need to do like a Dodger dog versus Fenway Frank comparison, because I have family on the West Coast and this is like a really contentious thing.
Yeah.
In our family. Like they're like, Dodger dog's the best. Don't think so.
I will be the first to say that a Dodger dog is just a regular hot dog, right?
That's what
regular hot dogs are good. I like regular hot dogs, but there's nothing special about a Dodger dog.
Hold on, Sam. So you think the Dodger dog is nothing special, but you think a Fenway Frank has some, because to be honest with you, my opinion on all the hot dogs is they're all just kind of different variations of hot dogs. I appreciate the Fenway Frank because I'm eating it at Fenway.
That's why I wanted to ask about the Seattle dog, because it's bizarre.
That's true. That's a weird thing.
I feel like
it honestly sounds like the Seattle dog is special because of the cream cheese, whereas the Dodger dog at least is nothing special.
Yeah, the Fenway dog is made from beautiful, like probably like boiled in like rainwater from the Fenway roof. That's delicious.
Okay.
Is that not appetizing?
Oh yeah, come on.
No, it's a regular hot dog, but it's good.
All right, man. We really appreciate you jumping on with us, Robert. We'll be down at spring training middle to end of March, so we'll be looking forward to seeing you then. But to the viewer, watch the games on TV. This guy's going to be throwing 99 mile an hour sinkers all spring, and we'll be rooting for you the whole time, man. Very excited to see it.
Quick caveat from sidearm: it'll be more like mid 90s, you know. But you know what are you going to do?
But it's going to be darting around the screen.
Yes,
it'll be
exactly.
It's oh yeah,
better, still throwing bowling balls. Metric. It doesn't matter.
Yeah,
me too. I'm only throwing 95 these days too, so that's all good.
Yeah, I'm down to like 92, but we appreciate it, man. We'll see you when we're down there. But best of luck. We'll be rooting for you all the whole time, and we'll see you in the fort. We'll see you in Boston.
Awesome, guys. Thank you.
What's on your mind right now? The song you can't get out of your head? That breaking story or that conversation you just have to be a part of?
That's a brand new song from...
This is a breaking news report.
He shoots! He scores!
That's radio. Happening now. Connecting you to what matters most exactly when it's happening. From the airwaves to every device you stream on, radio is everywhere you are. It's local, live, and it's for you. Tag your favorite radio station this Wednesday on social media and use hashtag National Radio Day to celebrate. That's hashtag National Radio Day.